Hey everybody, welcome back to Noggin Notes. I am your host, Jake Wiskirchen, and today we have Kelly White, who is going to be telling us about her personal story of grief and loss. And I'm not going to spoil it by explaining what she lost, other than to say it was really tough, and the ripple effect included many people around this agency. And I am really excited to have her talk because I think her story is going to be uplifting and inspiring to a lot of people. And I can tell you that having already conducted the interview, she provides a great deal of clarity on process as well as emotional functioning and how to move through a loss. I think she handled it very well, and she does a great job of demonstrating to us how to do it, as well as to teach what goes on. So I'm going to just leave it there, but also invite you, if you are struggling or you need somebody who, if you know somebody who's struggling, to go to take a free and anonymous mental health screening from our partners at Walk the Talk America. That's WTTA.org/love. Take a free and anonymous mental health screening today. Check in on yourself. And if you need more than that, maybe go to zephyrwellness.org and look at the emotional functioning videos that I have posted. Just type into the search bar under media and articles, emotional functioning, and it should pop right up for you. If it doesn't, actually, it would pop right up when you go to the emotional or the media and articles page itself. So check out WTTA.org/love as well as zephyrwellness.org. I'm glad that I have such great employees. I hope you find this as inspiring as I did, and try not to cry. And we're back to a new Noggin Notes. This time I'm joined by Kelly White, a proud intern of mine and employee of Zephyr Wellness. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on today.
First time podcast guest.
Yes.
Yeah. For the uninitiated, which would be you, and maybe anybody else who doesn't understand what goes on here, this is more of a conversation like two friends over a beer at the bar than it is some scripted thing. So we've got camera there and us talking here, and hopefully that works. And you know, maybe we'll see this on YouTube, maybe we won't. I have no idea. But I'm going to lower this lid because it really doesn't need to be up right now, other than to record us. So hi, why don't you introduce yourself beyond me just saying those few things and putting words in your mouth, like proud to be an intern and working at Zephyr. I don't know that you are. I assume that you are, but
well, hello. Yes, I'm Kelly White, and I am very proud to be working here at Zephyr Wellness. I am an MFT intern. I've been working here for roughly a year and a half now, a little less than that. But yeah, I love working here. I got my degree in Fresno, California, my master's degree in marriage and family counseling, and I love what I do, and I'm glad that I found this place when I moved up here 2 years ago.
Why did you pick MFT work?
I think I always wanted to do something with psychology and also helping people. When I was younger, I actually wanted to be a teacher. But as I got older and I just kind of delved into psychology, I really just liked the aspect of helping other people and their behaviors and being able to understand that. And in college, I took a family counseling class, and that specifically like really resonated with me. And
I really got bit by the bug. Yeah. I know how that works. I went through a similar journey myself. I had several false start careers, but I wanted to go one direction, then took a class that bit me and never looked back. Mm-hmm. Ended up having to re-enroll in a different program 2 years later, but it was good. So how's the journey been for you so far?
It's been really good, actually. I was definitely nervous in the beginning, you know, coming to a new city, especially, and not really knowing anybody, having to, you know, figure out just all of the Nevada laws coming from California. But you guys have made it just really welcoming here. Just any questions I have, you guys have been very forthcoming with that.
Meaning Nevadans or?
Well, no, you. You, Jesse, and Marina, yeah. And it's just been really helpful. Like, I don't think I have any questions, you know, and it's been nice being able to find who I am as a therapist. And obviously I'm still new into it, but being able to really like help people and understand what it is that I do and talk about it, you know, with other people and other therapists has been really helpful.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. This is not a commercial for Zephyr Wellness, though it could be. Thank you for saying that. It means a lot, and I don't mean to gloss over the compliments. I do want you to answer that question, though, that you just posed at the end. You probably didn't know that you posed it, but you came on this show for a specific purpose, and we will get there, but I want to know what it is that you think you do. Help maybe demystify this for some people who may be listening who are not savvy about the field. So mm-hmm. you concluded by saying, like, finding out what it is that I do. It's like, all right, so what is that that you do? Mm-hmm. What do we do in this profession?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely not give advice like a lot of people think, you know, they come into a session and just they want that help, right? But I think at least what I do specifically is help guide them into figuring out what it is that they want by identifying what their true sense of self is. You know, who am I? What is it that I want to do? Why do I feel this way about specific things? Like, how has my past led to where I'm at? And do I want to keep letting it, you know, lead me into that, you know, because I think more recently, specifically, I've gotten into a lot of the choice theory. And, you know, we do make these choices, you know, how much of your life do you want to be, you know, in this specific career, or, you know, doing these specific things, being around family members that you don't like and whatnot, and being able to really just identify that you can make that choice based off of who you believe that you are.
Yeah, you're not a product of things that have happened to you. You're a product of choices that you make either consciously or unconsciously in response to the things that happen to mm-hmm. you. I mean, that's advice that dates back thousands of years to Epictetus even, who yeah. probably originally uttered those words of, you know, you don't have a lot of control over what happens in your life. You have control over how you respond to it. So with that in mind, it sounds like a pretty generic framework to say that you're helping people guide themselves into wherever they want to be. Is that typically, I'm going to play ignorant here for a second and pretend I'm not your supervisor, but is that typically what walks through the doors, people who are seeking inner guidance? Because in my understanding, even in my fledgling understanding years ago, was that people come in with a problem, they want the problem solved. But you've painted it in a more of a deeper examination, exploratory brush than mm-hmm. just a stated issue needs resolution, right? So how do those two things work together? Somebody's ailing, like, you should go see someone. That's what we hear about, right? Mm-hmm. It's okay to talk about it. Well, what is it that we're talking about? And do they necessarily come in with that in mind? Or is that something that you steer them towards? Like, hey, if you find out more about yourself, you probably resolve this issue. Or mm-hmm. do you address the issue that they offer?
Right. I think with that, most of the time they do come in thinking it's just one problem that they have and this is what I want to do to solve it. But a lot of the times as we go through therapy and as we talk about what the problem is or how they've learned from it, what they're learning from it, that they identify, like, maybe I didn't even want that in the first place. I don't know how I got to that problem. And figuring out, okay, well, why did you? How did you lead yourself into that? And what do you want to do now that this problem has occurred? And so it's not specifically like, this is my problem, how do I fix it? But how do I just guess continue fixing my life so it's not, I'm not in the same pattern of having these same problems.
And if there is a specific instance that needs resolution that doesn't require deep digging, how do those two things work together?
I think it depends on what they come in for. I mean, we'll talk more about grief, but I think yeah. grief specifically, right? If you come in to therapy for grief, that is something that you can kind of just identify, help them process through it, and then they might not need therapy anymore. It's more the problems that are recurring or, you know, issues that are maybe boundary setting or the sense of self kind of things, you know, that they haven't truly been able to address.
That is a really good segue, because what you're here to discuss is your own issues with grief and loss recently, and I'm not going to spoil it for the listening audience. I'll let you tell the story, but I do want to know how you were guided, because you did seek your own therapy from someone else, and then we'll get more into the other stuff, but let's start there. Like, somebody comes in with grief, or let's say it's you, where do you start?
Well, when I went to therapy for grief, I think in my mind I had gone just because I thought I needed to go because I had lost somebody very, you know, close to me. And I think sometimes it's okay to just not be okay, and it's okay to sit in your grief and to be grieving, and you don't have to seek that extra help. I think that that's kind of just been something with maybe modern culture, that if I'm having a problem, I have to go get help.
Yeah, you got
to
accelerate it, right? There's there's this urgency. I think that's driven by a whole bunch of things, not the least of which is our instant gratification demands that have been programmed into our brains, probably not with permission. And then it ripples into other things like the grieving process, where it's like, I should, now there's an implied mm-hmm. should, right? The air quotes that you can't see if you're listening. I should be over this already. It's like, it doesn't matter what already is. It just seems to be not fast enough. Mm-hmm. And so we do work with people to slow down, be patient, let the thing take its time. But also, like you said earlier, counterbalance that with choice. Mm-hmm. How long do you choose to sit in this is entirely up to you.
Right.
Right. And whatever you pick is okay too. So giving permission to oneself to take as long as one needs without life disruptions, right? So go ahead, tell us what your grief was. This is the big story. This is what we wanted to share with people, right?
Yeah. So it's about 6.5 months ago now. So the beginning of August, I was 8 months pregnant. So 32.5 weeks roughly. So very far along. And I had developed a condition called cholestasis of pregnancy. I didn't know at the time that's what it was. I started being super itchy, like severe itchiness everywhere, and a few other small symptoms that, again, I had no idea. Like, you don't really learn these kind of things in the doctor's appointments if you don't have any genetic predispositions.
Yeah, you found out they're rare too, right? So it's not something that they're even going to tell you about.
Mm-hmm.
And weird things happen to the body when you have a person growing inside you. So like, to be itchy is not something you'd necessarily even pay attention to, because you're like, oh, whatever, body chemistry is changing, right? Mm-hmm. Must be that. That's got to be, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, and I had actually been to the hospital multiple times for back pain. And the times I had gone, they just checked to make sure I wasn't in labor, and I wasn't. And that was kind of it. They sent me home. I found out later with the cholestasis that I had had 10 gallstones. And I guess they had developed probably after I had my first son, even maybe before, because I'd always had just like random bursts of pain in my back. And I assumed, doctors assumed it was just from the labor. You know, you get pregnant, you have a baby, you have back pain for the rest of your life, essentially. And so when I had gone to the doctors, you know, the hospitals, nothing. They said everything was okay. And I didn't know. They didn't think to check, because it's not typically in the back. But I think with the expanded, you know, everything with the baby growing inside of me, it shifted to my back area. And so when I had told them, you know, I had the severe itchiness and that kind of thing, I had an appointment on Friday. I had the symptoms starting Sunday. And so they're like, okay, well, you know, when you come in Friday, we can just do some testing, see what's going to happen. And then it was Wednesday. So 3 days later that I didn't feel any movement. And I had known that something was wrong even before going in, because he was a kicker. He kicked all the time. I constantly felt him. And I just knew something was wrong. And I think part of me was scared. I didn't want to go to the hospital that night, because I had a feeling if I went in, then it would probably be bad news. And I eventually did. I went into the hospital, and the nurse came in. You know, she tried to find the heartbeat on the monitor. She couldn't find it, but was still trying to be hopeful. You know, oh, like, let me go get the doctor. Let's go see. You know, I think I might hear it, but I'm not sure. And then when the doctor came, did the check, you know, my husband thankfully was there with me. And she, you know, shook her head no. And instantly, just that dread, you know, that despairing feeling, we were just, and we didn't even know really what to think. We just were sobbing. You know, it was just the worst thing. Yeah, I still have that vivid image in my head, you know, of her shaking her head and just knowing, you know, that there was no longer a living baby inside of me. And there are so many things that go along with it, too, that you are not prepared for, you know, having to decide if you want to go into labor. You know, you have to still give birth when it's that far along. So deciding, do you want to go home? Do you want to stay? We can induce you. You know, like, how do you want to go about telling other people? We take pictures of the baby afterwards. We cremate them for you. And just hearing all of those things when you're in that state, it's kind of a shock. Like, you really don't know what to say, how to respond, how to even feel in that moment. It's just sadness. You know, you're just sad. You weren't expecting this to happen, and it happened. And in that moment, too, I think the first few days I was just in shock. You know, I was able to talk about it, to tell, you know, family and friends. And then when I got home, you know, when I had to go home without my baby and they took the baby away to cremate him and stuff, it was the hardest few days of my life. Like, I did not think I would ever come out of that, honestly. It was just such a bad feeling, and just so much sadness I truly did not know how I was going to be okay again.
You're telling this in a matter-of-fact, journalistic, almost manner, and I know it's been several months. I am trying my best to stay in my frontal lobe because I know if I allow myself to feel it, you know, I've got two kids of my own, 8 and 6. I very vividly remember the hospital, going home with your baby. It's life-changing, right? Even on the second one. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure people who have had multiple kids beyond number two say everyone changes your life, every additional one. I'm not allowing myself to go there because I don't want to distract from the interview, but it's calling me. And I really want to empathize, but I think sometimes we need to be strong to get through things. And so as clinicians, we certainly want that strength as well. And I want to ask you, so you're already out of work at this point because you've taken some time off in advance of the arrival of the baby. How long did the process take from the moment you got the bad news to having to make all the decisions about what was subsequently going to follow? And the second question on that is, do you think there could have been a different approach, bedside manner, length of time, allowance, something like that? Do you think it happened okay? And also, how long was that time span?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I found out, they gave us, I think, maybe 10 minutes to kind of just be with ourselves, you know, take your time, you know, we'll come back when you make that decision. They do ask you right away, though, you know, like, here are some of the things you have to think about. You know, do you want to be induced? Do you want to go home for a few, you know, days, even weeks? You're still early, you know, early enough that you don't have to give birth right away.
So you could keep it inside you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We could not do that, though. We decided that would be way too difficult.
It's very macabre, too, to think about. Once you know for sure, it seems, I don't know if disingenuous is the right word, but it seems almost like you're lying to yourself. Mm-hmm. If you, I don't know. It's also a little creepy to me. But I'm not the girl, right? I could certainly envision dad and dad's role, but it just seems like, ugh.
Yeah. It was just way too hard for us knowing, that he's in there. He's just, he's not breathing or alive. Thankfully, my husband and I were just kind of in agreement with everything. Like, it just, I mean, just thankfully. I mean, we just, everything was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We know that, and kind of moving forward. But then after that, I think I went into labor, so they induced me, and I didn't give birth until Friday morning.
Good grief.
Yeah, so I was induced and going through the labor process for like a day and a half, roughly. And so everything was still kind of, like I said, in shock. I mean, I was able to talk to the doctors about it. And I think, from my experience, I thought that they did pretty well, like being able to comfort me and being there for me when asking the questions, like when you go home, you have to decide if he's going to be cremated. We do that for you. We take care of everything. And again, it's just, you just don't expect any of that. So I don't know if there's a way that they could have done it differently, because in that moment, you're just so like kind of out of your mind that just you need that information. You have to make that decision.
You're on autopilot for the most part, I'm guessing. Did you have any of those thoughts? I mean, you're in labor for a day and a half. What were the thoughts going through your head, if you can even remember them?
Yeah, it was a lot. We had a lot of family. Thankfully, my older sister came into town. My mom and dad were there. My husband's parents came. And so I think just trying to surround myself with the support and know that this was happening, but also try not to blame myself for anything or think too much about it, honestly, in those first few days, because I knew
still don't know why at that point, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yeah. They were doing testing and I had a feeling I believed that it was the cholestasis because I had looked it up but I didn't know for sure. And even then, like finding out, it didn't really help much because I didn't know why at that point. Right, I didn't know I had the gallstones until a few days later. I went back to the hospital because of chest pain, and that's when they had told me that I had the gallstones, which they assumed was why I got the cholestasis. And so just those few days, it was just a lot of trying to, again, be with support, try and just be with my husband, especially, I knew that this was hitting him, I think, even harder than it was me. And I don't know how to really explain that. I think just in his position, he felt hopeless, or he thought he was hopeless, and that I can't do anything, right? This is happening to her and her body and the baby's inside of her. There's nothing I can do. So I felt, I think, more sad for him. Just
did he express that?
He did. Okay. Not in that moment, but later on. Right. Yeah, he had expressed that, you know, I blame myself. Like, I don't know. I couldn't have done anything to have changed it, but I must have done something to have caused this to happen.
And I think we all go through that, right? Isn't that one of the five stages? Is like, was blame one? I know it's like denial and acceptance and all that stuff. But we just did a podcast on this, and I'm embarrassed that I don't know it. But we
maybe did a WTTA cast. Maybe it falls into anger. I don't know.
Yeah, anger. Yeah, but there, I think there's some one of those is blame. Like you're trying to grasp for a reason, so you just like reach for the totally absurd. Right. That sucks. So anyway, sorry, go on.
No, yeah. And for him, I think with him blaming himself a lot, it made me be a lot more introspective of there is no reason like that this could have happened. You know, we are Catholic, so we're religious, and trying to sit and think, you know, why would God have done this to us? There's no reason. You know, I just chose to believe, you know, it's just there has to be a balance. You know, maybe we were strong enough to handle this, and I think now, like, we've kind of proven that we were able to. But in that moment, it's just, there is no reason. You have to just try and accept that this happened and move forward. And obviously, in that moment, you're not really thinking that much. I mean, I can say that now. In that moment, it's just, I don't want to blame anybody. I don't want to be angry. There's no reason to be angry. I'm just sad. You know, I'm just sad. I'm afraid because we found out, you know, that I have a 60 to 70% chance of it happening again just because I had gotten it. And again, there was no reason I would have known it was something possible. And we've always wanted, you know, four or five kids. So for us, there's a lot of fear in what that looks like for us going forward. But still hope. We still want to try at least one more time and kind of see what that's like for us. But just again, you know, I didn't want to be angry. I didn't want that to be how I valued the baby. I didn't want that to be how I saw that situation. You know, seeing it back, I feel blessed that I at least got to hold him. He was almost five pounds, 19 inches long. He was a big baby. I have big babies. And so, like, to hold a baby who probably wouldn't even have been in the NICU, even though he was, you know, 8 months, it's just, I'm just honored that I at least got that chance to be with him.
His name?
Sean, after my dad.
I think it's important to remember the names of people and what they brought to us, even if it was brief. And so that's why I asked that. Mm-hmm. Let's try to overlap the Venn diagram a little bit here. So you're a clinician, fledgling though you may be in your career, you're still a clinician. You're licensed by the state to do what you do. You have some insights. You have been a very good intern, I would say, and you were very intelligent and you work very hard and you consume a lot of content to augment your own abilities. Then you have this experience. What did you draw, if anything, from your job in application to this horrible thing that happened?
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, I think it was just knowing that I will be okay, and it's okay to not be okay in this moment. So being able to just sit with my family, just do what I needed to do to grieve in that moment. You know, my husband and I turned a lot toward each other, toward our son, our older son. He's 2. His name is James. And we wanted to just still be, you know, just live and be present. And in that, allow ourselves to grieve. You know, there were some nights that we were just sobbing. You know, it was just too hard to handle in that moment. But then also allow ourselves to grieve individually too. You know, like when we did do a service for him, and when we did the service, my husband kind of just needed that time afterwards, and he sat out there while we all went inside. And I could have gone out there, you know, and tried to comfort him in that moment, but I knew that he needed to have that time for himself to be with our son. And so I think it's important to know when you need it individually as well as together, you know, but doing it in your own way, because it does look different for everybody. You know, it's not one fix all. You know, I wish that it was, but it is, it's different, you know. And again, we can choose how we want to deal with it, but it is important to know how you do need to.
There's an important point that you made. You caught yourself when you said, "I felt like," and then you changed it to "believe." Anybody who's listened to me for any length of time knows that I'm a real stickler on feeling versus thinking. things that come from the frontal lobe can be changed. Things that come from the limbic system usually cannot, except by directing your attention elsewhere, and then you can influence your own emotions and moods. So you believed that it was the cholestasis, is that what it's called? But you weren't sure, and that is something that comes from the frontal lobe. You can change your mind about that. But you felt, I'm going to put words in your mouth now, you felt like something bad happened because Sean stopped kicking. And I want to draw a very distinct line between feeling emotionally and feeling physically, and then the feeling of sensation, right? It can be a spiritual, it can be an ethereal, it can be something sixth, we'll say. When you get information, when we acquire information, it influences our belief system, our interpretations, our impressions, some way that we view things, right? Or worldview. But then there are times when we just know without information. And I'm highlighting this for the listening audience, not just to be pedantic because I like language games, but also because, you know, language is important and we can influence the way that we interact with the world with our words. I don't want to throw out intuition and mother's intuition specifically when you have children should be obeyed because it usually means something important is happening. Have you second guessed your intuition along the way or since then, or have you had any reflection of any kind where you look back and you go, you're revisiting and you're hesitant or maybe it's even strengthened. You right. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, 2 points to that. First, I do think it was strengthened and I knew something was wrong. I went to the hospital for my back pain. I knew it wasn't just labor pains, mm-hmm. That there was something wrong. You know, I knew that this wasn't normal. It didn't seem right. This isn't what it's like
to your body.
Be pregnant. Yeah. In that, though, obviously, I wish I had advocated maybe more for that, and been like, no, like, do all the testing that you can. I didn't do that. And so it was strengthened in that I believe it, and I know that my intuition was correct in that. But just, wanting to advocate for myself even more now, when I do notice those things, like, really being vocal about it. And with that, too, it's important I don't sit in that, I could think of all the would have done differently. But that's not what happened. That right. is what happened. And I need to, learn to accept, but moving forward, I have this chance again. So how do I want to ensure that I do advocate for myself and I make sure that, if something is wrong with my body, that I speak up about it, and just try and believe the intuition even more so.
That's, I'm glad you went that direction with it. That's where I was hoping you'd go, which is that we don't dwell in the past ruminating on things that we can't change because we literally lack the information when we decided at the time. What we do is we start to tune in and listen a little more closely when it surfaces again in the future so that we don't override it. I think we're all working on this. I mean, I can certainly speak for myself, but sometimes in the clinical setting, we help people to obey that because it's been overridden for so long, or they've been taught not to listen to their own instincts, and then bad things happen, and then we get into self-shaming and that kind of thing. I'm glad you're not doing that. I'm glad your takeaway was to trust yourself, right? But then let's talk a little bit about the knowledge acquisition that you got afterward, which was, okay, you had this cholestasis thing created by gallstones. You had your gallbladder removed. Is that right? Okay. Yeah. Getting super personal here.
Yeah. No, it's okay. On my other son's birthday.
Yeah. So something else that I'm highlighting, not necessarily just for you, but it is, but also for the listening audience, we going back to the thinking versus feeling thing. Oftentimes when we get in a situation where there's deep pain, it's a limbic response. It's your emotional center saying sadness is here, right? And if you ride through the emotional, and I'm looking at it right there on my whiteboard, there's the emotional wave and a chain analysis and a crudely drawn picture of the brain. You can see all those in the Zephyr Wellness videos if you want. But The point is, you're in this pain, and the first thing that our modern Western cultured brains reaches for is reason and logic and understanding, and that's a frontal lobe thing. So if you got two parts of the brain that aren't doing work simultaneously, you can have all the answers in the world, which is what you got. You got cholestasis caused by gallstones, possibly caused by genetics or diet or whatever, right? Doesn't matter. You run that back. Why? Yeah. Okay, you have the why now, but you're still in pain. My theory is that it's just simply the wrong part of the brain working. You have to sit, like you said, you have to sit in the pain, and it's okay to be not okay for a while. And no explanation is going to take that away.
Right.
It's very, very challenging to understand something and then set aside the emotional component. You have to do both.
Yeah.
How has your journey been since then, working with patients who come in who express emotional outbursts, ideation, experience, and wanting to know cognitively what's going on? But you've gone through this. Now you know experience. You've had the experience of like walking through it and be like, it doesn't matter how many answers I give you. You're just going to have to deal with this. Like, how is that applied clinically? And it's something just for, you know, education's sake. There's something called transference when the patient reads something into us that reminds them of themselves or whatever. And countertransference is when we do it to them, when we see ourselves in them. So talk a little bit about that and the overlap.
Yeah. Well, definitely in the beginning, I did have a lot more countertransference and just hearing people's pain, you know, and how they're processing. But in that, it also showed me that I believe I'm doing well. You know, I was able to sit in the pain and allow myself to do that and find the support and understand what it is that I needed, and not sit in the whys, right? Or what could have been differently or why, you know, what happened. It didn't matter to me at that point, you know? And so there was a lot of that in the beginning and definitely a lot less now, you know, occasionally sometimes, but I never let it like change the way that I work in a way that's like, oh, I'm feeling this, I have to make them feel the same way I'm feeling, or I have to
Don't ever do that. If you're a fledgling therapist or any therapist, don't ever do that.
And like, I didn't want to teach them specifically what I did, you know, because everyone's journey is different. But it definitely helped me in being able to talk about, you know, the limbic system and thinking logically and those things and how they correlate to one another and just to what we experience, as well as just being able to allow them to sit in it, you know, because a lot of the times they're just trying to find these answers, but they just need to sit and talk about it and to grieve or to, you know, to feel the sadness or the fear and understand what it is that they're feeling too. You know, a lot of times, again, people feel angry, but there's actually nothing that they want to change. It's just that they're sad and they're afraid, and understanding what it is that you are truly feeling and allowing them to feel that.
I'm glad that you taught that point just now about the anger, because I was going to ask you earlier, why didn't you go to anger? Because you said, I didn't want to be angry about it. But you just explained something that I talk about in the emotional functioning stuff from Izzard, which is anger motivates to make change. If you can't make change out of something, it's probably not worth being angry over. So what's below the anger that you really need to attend to? For you, it was sadness. What was therapy like? You went into, you got some counseling for yourself. What'd you work on?
So I went in, I only did 3 sessions, and like I said in the beginning...
See, it can be done.
And like I said in the beginning, though, I more so went in just because I thought I needed to, because, you know, I lost a baby, of course I need to go to therapy. But I think I was grieving as healthily as I needed to. You know, I was surrounding myself with support, I was allowing myself to grieve. You know, thankfully you guys gave me that time, so I was able to just not have worries and just kind of be with myself, be with my family. And I know I do have that, you know, fortune. I know not a lot of people get that. So I do want to acknowledge, like, I know I am very fortunate that I was able to do those things, and not everyone has that capability.
How do you mean?
Just, I have a lot of family. I have a lot of support, a lot of people that came, you know, and I was able to take that time to, you know, to grieve. But in going to therapy, I think just being able to talk about it to someone else, you know, and to kind of sit on the other side of being a therapist and just allow myself to be like, okay, I don't have to talk about this like a therapist. I don't have to clinically, you know, figure this out. I can just talk about it.
Was that hard?
It was.
First time in counseling? Or did you do it before?
Yeah, I had never been to therapy. So for me, it was hard to kind of sit on the other side and not think about it clinically, but just trying my best to be like, okay, this is just what I'm feeling. I just need to talk about it and just need to let myself feel it. And I think with, you know, having family who was also grieving, I mean, my friends who reached out, you know, my family who reached out, they were all grieving in their own way too. And I understood that. So
us too.
Yeah. Here, yeah. And so I didn't want to like project how I was feeling on other people or anything. I just, you know, and I think as a clinician at times I would maybe do that, or just like that, you know, it's okay to grieve, like allow yourself, but I just needed to be. So I think in being a patient, I was able to just be and just sit in it a little bit more than I was at home.
That's a really excellent insight. I can tell you what I have to turn off and what switches I have to flip when I'm just letting go and being honest with another human being, because it's very hard switching modes from, I mean, I'm basically always the guy that people come to, right? Yeah. Like whether it's professionally in the office because they hired me and, you know, insurance is paying, or I'm doing it with you guys as a supervisor, or it's just friends, family from the community because I'm the guy who works in mental health. But I'm curious what you had to disconnect from and switch your mind around. Like what was the actual thing that you're like, oh, I need to not do this in order to be fully present and allow myself to be a patient? What are some of those things?
Well, in the first little bit of the session, the very first session, I think I was still thinking that way because I was just kind of explaining it how I'm doing here and not really getting emotional. You're
like, this is the intake, right? Like, so I'm this age and I got these kids.
I think it was more in the second and third session I was able to, I wish I knew specifically, but I think just allowing myself to be like, okay, just telling myself, you don't have to be a therapist right now. You don't have to think about it in that way. Just sit in it, just grieve. You don't have to explain it to the therapist. Like, she doesn't need to know all the specifics of what happened. I can just tell her why I'm feeling this way or what's coming from feeling this way and that kind of thing. So I don't know. I wish like I had a specific answer for that, and to what I like turned off or switched or did differently. But I think it's just a lot of that thought of like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a clinician. I'm just going to just be authentic in how I'm grieving in this moment.
You're describing something approximating a surrender, I think, and a trust, which, and you're right about not needing every detail. I think people sometimes come into therapy and we screw it up too, where we ask too many questions about things that don't matter. And then they volunteer too many things that we don't care about. And it turns out most of us by and large are pretty good at reading through reading between the lines and concluding things that are pretty darn accurate without needing hours and hours and hours of backstory, right? So if you're listening to this and you want to go into therapy and you've never been, or you have been and it sucked and you want to go back, we don't need all your details. We just need to know why you're there, and we can help you with the rest. But that, I think, just the self-reassurance of telling yourself, I'm in the presence, I'm putting words in your mouth again, but I'm in the presence of a professional. I don't need to, you know, be helping them through this, right? Like that's really key. How is James doing? Is he aware of what happened?
Thankfully, I don't think so. He was 2. He had just turned 2 the week after I lost the baby, and he was never really one to like look at my stomach when it was getting bigger and go baby or anything like that. So I don't think he truly knew. I mean, he might, and obviously, like I have been paying attention to his behaviors and everything like that, but it doesn't seem like he's been affected by it. We definitely do want to, when he gets older though, kind of explain, you know, what happened, and not so much as like, this is everything, right? But just, you know, you had a brother, you know, he's up in heaven, and kind of explain what that is, and allow him to also figure out what that means to him. You know, I had heard someone say that they had lost their child and their sibling was old enough though, you know, to have known them, but they, you know, made them posters for when they would have graduated. They celebrated their birthdays, all of those kinds of things, and to allow him that, you know, but in that also not taking away from him at all, you know, because again, his birthday was the week later and we didn't want to take anything away from him, you know.
Oh man, like, that's gonna be hard. Yeah, I just clicked.
Yeah. Yeah, it was it was his birthday party, and it was actually also supposed to be the baby shower. And we could have decided, like, okay, let's just cancel it, you know. But we decided, okay, no, like, James wants to still celebrate. You know, it's his birthday. He still wants this, and it'll be good to be around a bunch of family. So we, you know, we told everybody, you know, it's not a baby shower anymore, but still come to celebrate James. And I was actually in the hospital getting my gallbladder removed. So it was kind of nice because I didn't have to be there. Yeah. Cause I did think it would be a little overwhelming for Matt and I, my husband. But it was nice, like, getting home and being able to see everybody and just allow James to have that, you know, because I'm sure he was sad in a way because I was at the hospital. Matt and sure. I were both at the hospital for, like, kind of a week overall, you know. And so being able to just be with family, celebrate himself, have some cake, you know, I think was really good for him.
We'll see how that unfolds. I'm curious because I mean, you know as well as anybody who's listened to that, I got a nice deep spiritual connection. I try to follow Jesus, and I think that there's got to be a connection between would-be siblings that at some point something will ping him, mm-hmm. you know, and I wonder if he's not got a little angel sitting on his shoulder right now too as I start to tear up. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go back to the counseling. How did you know that you didn't need more? Was that a decision you made, or did the therapist help you with that, or what?
Well, we agreed on it, but I had brought it up just because when I was going, I was just talking about a lot of the things that I would kind of talk about with my support. You know, I was able to...
You're like, I don't need to hire a professional for this. I got people.
Well, so, and I think, like, it was just that, you know, I was able to talk about it, to sit in it, and then I learned, you know, a couple things, and then I was like, well, I don't think that me coming here is necessarily making me grieve anymore or differently. So I was like, I think I'm okay to just do this on my own because I'm not on my own. Like, I have all of the support and my husband and everything like that. So then she agreed, you know, yeah, you're healthy. It's not, you know, impacting your daily functioning or anything like that. Like, you're able to get up and still do things and go out and talk to people and whatnot. Because I know a lot of people can avoid in that time, right? Yeah. I'm going to avoid it. I don't want to deal with it. I'm just going to shut myself off. And I wasn't doing any of that. And so I think we kind of decided, well, since it's not impacting me and my functioning, I'm able to do things, that it's okay that I can do it on my own.
Would I be incorrect in saying that your clinical training helped in that? Because the way you just laid that out, you're like, well, it's not impacting my functioning. Nobody mm-hmm. talks like that right. unless you're in the industry. Did that inform your decision?
I think so. Because if I hadn't known, you know, like, oh,
I'm not meeting criteria.
Well, yeah, I'm like, I'm still getting up. I'm still, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sleeping okay. I'm eating. I'm not, you know, avoiding again. I'm doing these things that I'm okay. I think it was also just, I just believed that I was getting better. Like, it wasn't as many hard days. It was just hard moments that I was going through. And so I think that alone too, because I went to therapy roughly a month after it happened. So not right away. And so I think at that point I had already known I was doing okay, but I just wanted that extra reassurance.
Yeah, you got validated. Yeah. And that's good that the clinician didn't try to steer you into staying on or reading to whatever's going on and see more problems than there actually are, or manufacture things, because I've heard some horror stories. Did Matt ever join you in those sessions?
He did not.
Okay. Did he ever seek counseling on his own, or has he just pushed through and been okay too?
He hasn't yet. He actually did reach out though, well, to me, but to and told me to reach out to somebody because he was finally ready to go and to talk about it.
How long did that take?
A few months. Okay. It was maybe a month or so ago that he finally reached out. And I think he was just sitting in the anger for a long time and blaming himself. Though we were able to talk about it and, you know, we were able to grieve together, he was still, I think, stuck in that because he's very much like, I'm a provider. I want to take care of my family. And so he was disappointed in himself because he thought that he, you know, did something to make this happen.
Yeah. Man stuff. Yeah, that's really challenging. I mean, not to diagnose your husband, but if the presentation is what I think it is, if he's sitting in anger, he's not dealing with the pain, right? So, and you know that, but you can't tell him that because you're too close. But that's a lesson more for the people listening about, like, if you're grumbling, you're not addressing whatever the more vulnerable thing is underneath. It could be shame. It could be guilt. Mm-hmm. It could be sadness. It could be, you know, a whole host of things that aren't anger. Anger acts as a proxy emotion oftentimes. And so the brain feels something, but it's not the right thing. And therefore it never gets resolved. You never actually close the loop. So good for him for doing that. That's awesome. And, you know, and I know you well enough to know that you weren't rationalizing. But if I'm a skeptical listener who's hearing you explain this very, what seems to be fluid, easy process, I would want to know, how do you know that you're not lying to yourself? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I sat in it and I dealt with it and I faced it and I wasn't hiding in my room under the covers with the shades drawn. And I went to therapy a month later and the therapist was like, you're okay. Right? Like, I believe you. Because I know how you've operated since then and some of the decisions you've made here and patients to see and not see based on your own parameters and your own ability to steer through boundaries. How do you know that you're being honest?
Mm-hmm. It's just in the way that I do things and take care of myself, I think. Like, I have always been able to, I guess, withstand heavy emotions. And I haven't experienced anything, obviously, even close to what this was for me, but I've experienced grief before, sadness, pain. You know, before I had James, I actually had miscarried at 6 weeks. And so that was a lot to process too. And this is my third pregnancy and I only have one living child. And so I've experienced, you know, things before and pain and all of that. And I think it's really just knowing, like, I'm going to be okay. So it's okay if I'm not okay right now. Like, I can just be sad and I don't have to explain to people why I'm sad. I don't have to say I'm okay. You know, and for a long time when people asked, like, how are you doing? I didn't say I'm okay. I just said, you know, I'm figuring things out. You know, I'm trying to heal and I'm doing these things that I need to, but I wouldn't say I'm okay because that didn't feel authentic to me because I wasn't. And so I think just, I don't know, and just doing things like I've been walking a lot more, you know, just going on walks around my neighborhood. There's a lot of mountains and like nature kind of stuff. I've tried to cut back on caffeine, which is very difficult, but I just was like, that makes me anxious and it makes me feel all these other emotions that, you know, I don't need to feel. So I'm just going to cut back on that. Drinking a lot more water, you know, trying to drink or trying to eat less fast food and that kind of thing, which also kind of had to with the gallbladder. But just I was making these choices to ensure I was setting myself up for success, I guess. You know, I could have sat and, you know, wallowed away and done all of these things, but I knew, okay, if I do that, I'm not going to feel good. I need to get up and do these things and be active and engage in stuff with my son. And so I think a lot of it is like I just had the knowledge behind it, but I mean, I still could have. I mean, a lot of us have knowledge and still choose to avoid and still choose to do these things. And I still, every now and then, like, I still think, well, what if, you know, and I'm like, no, I don't want to think that. It doesn't matter. And so it still happens. Like, I mean, I still feel it. I still feel the sadness. I still question sometimes, like, why did this happen? What if I would have, you know, known it was gallstones? And then I just kind of swatted away right away. Like, it doesn't matter. This is what happened. I need to move forward. You know, how am I going to move forward? So it does happen still all the time, but I'm able to just catch myself a lot more, kind of like with that repetitive behavior. You have to just constantly keep doing it and eventually it won't be there anymore.
You dropped some nuggets in there. I'm not sure if you were aware of it or you intended to, but early on you were talking about the awareness of authenticity. You weren't going to say I'm okay if I'm not okay because it didn't feel authentic. And then you gave plenty of examples, and I want to put different words to it, of the hybridization between cognition, which is your knowledge, and you said, you know, you've got knowledge now, and the feeling part, and self-awareness. So there's three things in that little Venn diagram, I guess. So there's actual knowledge and understanding, there's feeling, emotional or physical, and personal self-awareness. And what you demonstrated there, I think, is a super healthy way of going through any process. If you can be mindful of those things and not act solely out of any one of them, because I think that's when you get into trouble, you can be pretty healthy. And you don't. And you also touched on something that I don't know if you're aware of. You didn't do a comparison to people. Like, when people come up and ask, "Are you okay?" You weren't allowing yourself to be influenced to conform to what you think they need you to be, right? You can just be you. You can just sit in it. You need to be sit in it. You don't have to perform for anybody. That's awesome too. And then I think that's all part of self-awareness. Do you practice or have you practiced authenticity? Is that a thing for you?
Like specifically?
Yeah, like is it a mantra or a personal value?
I think just growing up, I've always wanted to just be me and figure out what that is and be okay with like being weird or being different. You know, I wasn't popular or anything like that. I was well known. I was always just trying to be nice. And, you know, I got like, for high school, I got the best personality award. And to me, I was like, what the heck?
This
like,
old thing?
I didn't imagine, like, I never imagined getting something like that because I was always just trying to be myself and not try and conform to social media.
There's a lesson in there.
And I mean, obviously social media does play a role, right? Like yeah. I do see these things, but I just tell myself, well, they're just showing a minute of their life. You know, that's not really truly who they are. And so like, I've never, you know, posted things like that on Instagram. Like I post just family pictures and stuff. And
well, it's who you are. It's authentic.
Yeah. And in that too, we cover our son's face on social media. Like we don't post him because we just want him to also like grow up with that saying, like he can just be him. He doesn't have to have all of these things, you know, that are reflecting who he is or what other people think he is. And so I think just in doing that, like in wanting our son to grow up that way too. Just in growing a family too, it's really helped expand who I am and know who I am.
Yeah, that's all really good stuff. Really rich content probably for another discussion, especially regarding the kids on social media. I didn't really care. It's like put my kids' pictures on social media. But that was before AI. And now AI is spoofing people, including children. And I think it's increasingly dangerous to put our children on social media, especially without their consent. You know, I know that parents have parent rights and child rights are now a thing that's being talked about. And I think it's garbage. But you got to be mindful of that, right? I love that you're framing it in a way that you're respecting his autonomy to be who he wants to be later on and not be formed and shaped by whatever you guys are doing, right? So that's pretty cool. You have a session to get to, and I have supervision to get to, or maybe we're both going to supervision.
Yeah, I'm going to supervision.
Yeah, we can eat into that. Nobody cares. But I want to wrap this up, and there was something else I wanted to connect, though, and it's the spirituality part. So I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that having faith in outcomes as they should be is a big contributing factor to recovery and recuperation. You mentioned really early on, and I didn't want to forget it, and I'm glad I didn't, that there is no why to this. You know, why would God allow this to happen or whatever? Like people go right there and they shake their fist at the sky and whatnot. And that you said something really key, which is it just happened. It just was, right? Which is very non-attached. It's very Buddhist, actually. It just is. We don't have to make sense of it. We don't have to describe it. We don't have to even feel one way or the other about it. We do, of course. But I know my own belief system pretty well because it's mine. and I've examined it. But I want to know what your response is to the following. Bad things happen because we're in a fallen world. What do we do about it?
That's a hard one.
It is, and it was intentionally framed that way.
Right. With that, I think just in the way that we handle things and what we take from those bad experiences, you know, and we can shape who we are and what we want to do moving forward and shape the people around us, right? Like me, the way that I grieved.
You're back to that choice theory thing again. Right?
The way that I grieved, you know, like showed other people around me, like it's okay to grieve. She's going to be okay. You know, like she went through this terrible thing and she's okay again. And so I think with that, just knowing like even if bad things do happen, what you take from that and what you do with that is important. And that can shape you and everyone else around you because we can't control what, you know, the person next to me is going to do. I can try and influence in the best way I can, but I can't control them. And so just focusing on what you can do and what moving forward you want to do with your life. And that bad situation.
That's pretty sound. That was not what I expected you to say. I'm glad you did, though, and I think that's really good. It's a way to end this interview. Being able to have perspective and then knowing that we are in full control of how we respond, I think, is the thematic element that wove throughout this. Something we've been doing with the Walk the Talk America podcast is we do takeaways at the end, just like we do in supervision. So I'm particularly grateful. I know that you appreciate what we provide here. You gave me this little plaque for the listening audience. You can't see it, but it says World's Okayest Boss. And that was my Christmas present. And I'm very proud of that because it's the first time in 8 years, well, you know, we're in our ninth year now, 8 Christmases of owning the company that anybody's ever given me a gift. But my takeaway from this interview is that I am still, I'm going to cry. I still continue to be impressed by the level of insight, awareness, and professionalism of my employees. And I'm very grateful for that. But I know that you're going to give a precious gift to many listening audience members when they hear this. And it will come in a variety of different forms. Some of it will be strength. Some of it will be validation. Some of it will just be curiosity and insight. Some of it will be clinical training and application to their own practices. But regardless, I'm really pleased that you're here. I'm grateful for your vulnerability and your willingness to share. And I just continue to be blown away by the talent that I'm surrounded by in our hallways. So what is your takeaway from this?
Well, first, thank you for saying that, you know, because it is really hard to know when you're in this that you are doing okay, you know, that other people can see that and mm-hmm. reflect from it. Now I'm going to cry. I've been fine this whole time. But I think just my
turns
takeaway
out you
is,
can just be in it.
Yeah. That my takeaway is, you know, even though it seems like I'm, you know, just being able to talk about this, right, logically and all of that, like, I did struggle a lot. Like, it was not easy those first few days, months even. I was out of work for a month and a half, and it was so difficult. I mean, just sitting in that, you know, it's not easy, you know, being able to allow yourself. Like, no one wants to do that. I didn't want to sit in that and think of all the sadness and feel it, but I chose to because I just knew I needed to be okay again for my family, for myself, for my son. And so now, yes, I can sit, I can talk about it and I'm okay, but I wasn't for a very long time. And it's just important to know, like, you might not be okay for a long time or what seems like a really long time, but you can be. And it's not just time that heals it. I mean, it is what you do in that time to yes. heal. So being able to just allow yourself that, do what you need to do, and then know you will be okay again.
And it will look different mm-hmm. for everybody, yeah. right? Thanks. Appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You know, share this around if you found it helpful and useful. Invite others to join us on this journey. And, you know, on behalf of the Zephyr Wellness family and the Noggin Notes team, like always, we wish you all great mental wellness. Bye-bye.